Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman. My guest today is Alexandrine Poutreau-Fournier, the author of Aerial Imagination in Cuba, Stories from Above the Rooftops, published this year by Routledge. This wonderful book is composed of what she calls ethnofiction, coming out of her own ethnographic work in Cuba, but distilling the stories, which makes for a powerful poetics and sense of narrative. There are drawings as well by José Manuel Fernández Lavado, and these do much more than illustrate. They contribute to a book that is really a creative work of art. She begins by looking up at the sky, and it's from that simple shift of the gaze that all the stories emerge. Welcome, Alex. I'm so happy to be speaking to you today.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very, very happy to be here as well.
So this book is a little bit unusual, the aerial imagination, right? It's an ethnography of the sky, and it's not something that we often think of as needing an ethnography. Second of all, there are these amazing illustrations, and I've never seen a book with illustrations quite like this. I'm going to have you talk a little bit about that. And then also, there's a kind of very poetic structure to the book itself, with each chapter is a kind of discrete story, and you call them ethnofictions, right? I really want to hear you talk first just about how you got the idea for this book as a kind of this beautiful object that it is, and with the content that it has in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the idea for the book emerged as I was conducting field work about sound and digital music, electronic music and musicians in Eastern Cuba, in Santiago de Cuba. And that was in 2015. And I was in Santiago de Cuba at the time when new Wi-Fi stations were posted everywhere on the island. And in Santiago de Cuba at that time, there were Wi-Fi antennas installed in the Central Park and also in a back alley close to a telecommunication office in Cuba. It's called ETEXA. So that was huge at the time because for the first time, Cubans had access to Wi-Fi connections in public areas, basically. And that really changed the mood of the park and the way that people hang out in the park. People were like from one day to another going to the park to be able to connect and talk to their family, friends who live abroad, or just get access to the internet. But one thing that I noticed right away is that people were positioning themselves close to the antennas, like as a way to increase their the quality of their connection to the internet and to Wi-Fi in general. And that's something that really surprised me at first and caught my attention, because I didn't even know what a Wi-Fi antenna looked like before. And that's despite the fact that, of course, in Canada, I had access to Wi-Fi in public spaces at university or in cafes, etc. But I didn't even know what it looked like. While in Cuba, Cubans were really like looking for those antennas and placing themselves close to those antennas. So what it did is kind of shifted my gaze towards horizontal type of vision. So my gaze went up, you know. So if I kind of make a comparison, before my ethnographic gaze, I was more looking at like people and, you know, having that horizontal gaze. Yes. But then with the Wi-Fi, like I just turned my head towards up, you know, towards the sky in a vertical way. And I was like, wow, there's so many things happening on the rooftop, or some things are happening in relation with the sky that we never really talk about. And then when I just started with this, it became a kind of an obsession. Like every time someone was telling me a story about something happening in the sky or in relation with the sky, it really caught my attention. And then it just began to roll and become a big topic. And also something else that happened more or less at the same time is that when I started to look at the rooftop, I noticed that in Santiago de Cuba, there was a lot of people who would put cactus in front of their house, on the roof, but in front of the house. And I had conducted research in Cuba for more than 15 years and never noticed that there were cactus on people's rooftop. But then in 2015, it was like, wow, there's so many people having cactus on their rooftop. There must be a reason why. And asking people, that's when I started to understand, and that they were telling me that actually it's connected with the belief, religious beliefs, and I can talk more about it later. But so it had a huge connection with religions, with household, with even family, the notion of protection, etc. So a lot of stories came out of my interest to look at the sky as an ethnographic territory, if you want. So that's how it started.
Yeah. And how did you come to this idea of ethnofiction as a way to tell all of these stories?
So ethnofiction comes from cinema for me, because I'm a visual anthropologist. I'm interested in films, and not just with films, but that's one of my interests. In ethnographic film, there's the work of Jean Rouch, who's a French cinematographer and anthropologist who's worked a lot on the west coast of Africa. And he developed that technique, what he called, the technique that became associated with his work is called ethnofiction. And that technique is, he would ask the people he would work with, so that could be like at the time they were calling them like research informants, but now we talk more about, we refer to them as participants or collaborators. To perform a little bit their role, or to perform who they were in life, and he would make a film about that. So he would create a story with them, work with those collaborators to act their own role in a film. So it was it became films based on reality, but. So based on kind of, yeah, based on reality, but also playing with fiction. So the people playing their own roles were playing their own roles, but also playing with fiction. So that's how that mix between ethnography and fiction really caught my attention. And I decided to do this, but not in cinema, but in writing. So what I did is... for this book, I conducted ethnographic fieldwork, which included interviews, observation, participant observation about the notion of the sky and other topics, but that was one of them. And I use all of those interviews or what people were telling me about the sky or that I was interested in and invented stories. So those stories that I invented are based on ethnographic material, but they are the result of I would say, a manipulation or almost invention, stories that I made up. So it's not 100% fiction, but it's not 100% kind of ethnographic material.
So listening to you talk about these, it strikes me that that's also what the illustrations are doing, right? Because they're not photographs. So they're not kind of, you know, representations exactly of what happened, but they're renderings of the stories that you're telling. I don't know if that's what you intended, but I was really struck by them. I think they're very beautiful, and I hope that our listeners go rushing to buy your book so that they can read it and also see the illustrations.
Yes, thank you. The illustration, the work was with Jose Manuel, who's the artist with whom I collaborated for this project, and I knew I already had collaborated with him in the past because we had worked on animation for a film. So I know him for the last maybe 10 years, and I really liked his style and really liked the way that he painted the sky. So even before I had the idea of doing a book about the sky, I noticed that is the sky when he was painting or in his art in general, there was a lot of dots and a lot of because he works with the aquarelle, so I don't know how to say aquarelle in English. Actually, it's watercolors. So he works a lot with watercolors and just leaves the drops on his paintings fall anywhere, and it creates interesting patterns and interesting connections with different shapes. So anyway, I was interested in that, and that's why I asked him if he would be interested in collaborating again on this book project, and he accepted. And it was very interesting working with him because I came up with the stories, as I just said, and then we were sitting together and we worked on a script, and he came up also with ideas of how we could put those stories into images. Because I have to say that at the beginning, my idea was to create a film about the sky, but I soon realized that it would be very hard and that a lot of the things that actually travel or circulate in the sky are invisible. So drawing really allowed us to try to imagine those things moving in the air, those things circulating in the sky that could not be seen or that could not be captured with a camera, but that could kind of become visible with drawing and with the pen. So that was the idea behind the drawing and why I decided to work with him, because he's a very talented artist. And maybe at the beginning too, I wanted to do more of a graphic story or novel, you know, having the drawings more present than the writing. But because of his style, I soon came to the conclusion that it would be harder to do this because it took him so much time. Every drawing is so, as you say, like I invite the listeners to go see those drawings, but it's each line one at a time, you know, it's very long to do one drawing. So there's no way that we do a graphic, full graphic novel. So that's why we decided to do more illustrated type of stories. And that where the drawings would have their importance, but that the text too would accompany those drawings. So yes, definitely the drawings helped create that fiction, but also speak to the ethnographic material, because a lot of the characters that he drew are real people, you know, like that are people that who talk to me about the sky or told me stories. Were actually, that's what I explained in the book. They're part of my family, almost everybody in the book. That my husband is Cuban, and so his family lives in Santiago, and they became part of the book in many ways. So they are real people, but the things that happen in those stories did not necessarily happen like that, because that's part of the creating the narrative or the story of the stories. So
let's talk about those stories, because they're really fascinating. And I do think that, you know, I mean, what's so interesting is that you do invent these characters, but, or you base them on real characters, but there's always a kind of, I don't know how to describe it, but there's a truth about Cuba today in each of the chapters, and each of them draws out a different kind of truth. So the Wi-Fi for instance, kind of the obvious thing is the digital scarcity and the way that people kind of search around for internet. But then you connect that also to the kinds of non-Wi-Fi networks that support the Wi-Fi networks and really draw attention to those. And then also this idea of resolver, which is so prevalent beyond the focus of the state, right? And so it's this this wonderful ethnography in that the state is not that present. And then you're making all of these other connections to the sky.
Yes. I think that the sky is what connects everything, right? But that I start from there. But then there are so many things that are connected to the sky. And that's the beauty of it. Because, and in many ways, I think you could do the same exercise with anything, I guess. But me, I did it with the sky. So you start from the sky and then you you come up with a character. And then then you realize that, oh, it's connected with, the Wi-Fi antenna, because the Wi-Fi antenna, the signals travel through the sky. And how does that connect with how people live on an everyday life basis? And how do they use those, how people use those signals on an everyday life basis? What are their challenges, their barriers, and also the ways that they cope with, as you mentioned, scarcity, but also with an infrastructure that is maybe not is not reliable or that does not meet the desires and the needs of the people. So you obviously have to connect with, you obviously have to make connections with other questions of not only politics, but also of desire, trying to cope with a daily life that is not easy, with poverty, etc. So the sky allowed me to make connections with unexpected things. And something else that I have to say too is that each of the chapters, I was very interested in each of those topics. So the Wi-Fi had already done ethnographic fieldwork on the topic. I knew quite well what was going on at the time. I had talked to the telecommunication company workers. I talked to the illicit sellers of Wi-Fi connection in the park. I talked to users of the internet. You know, I had a good idea of what was going on. And then after, I created the story. So I think that the first step was really to have a very good sense of what's going on. When I felt that I had a good sense of what was going on, then that's when I was working on the story. But that first step was very important, and that's why it connects with real life or the truth. Yeah, as you mentioned.
So with the cactus. You make the point, you make the argument that it inhibits circulation as opposed to the Wi-Fi, which kind of promotes circulation, right? And you also tie it to the so fascinating story of house construction in Cuba and the acquisition of materials. So can you walk us through that story just a little bit?
So, it's interesting because the construction topic is becoming now an interest that I want to develop more research about that topic, because it is a fascinating topic. When you go to Cuba, you notice that everybody is renovating their house or trying to, or is in construction, trying to find the materials. It's hard to imagine, but in Cuba, you don't have a hardware store like we would have in North America, where you go, you buy your nails, your all the equipment, the wood, and everything you need to renovate or to construct something. In Cuba, everything has to be found a bit by bit in different types of networks and systems, sometimes illicit, legal, illegal type of networks, where you get the cement, the bags of cement in one place, you get the gravel in another place, the sand, and you know, like you try to bring all that together, to mix everything. So it's a big stress for many Cubans, construction and renovation. It's actually what many people told me, it's the biggest stress that Cubans have right now, is related to their house, to the housing situation, and to the renovation. So it's a big concern for Cubans. And of course, like the concept of home, housing, family, it's very important for many of them. So it really speaks to them, to their reality. So the story of chapter two is about Mary Elena, who is trying to construct a house or a bigger house because her house is too small. And she's in that kind of process of trying to acquiring bit by bit different type of materials and tools. But everything goes against her. So the weather destroys a wall that she constructed. Then she loses her bags of cement because her living room is so damp that the bags got wet, etc. So everything plays against her. So she decides that she needs to. You know, every time something happens to her, she's praying for help. She's calling the saints because she believes in the power of the saints of Espiritismo, Santeria. But she says, like, she needs something very strong to protect her household from those disasters, what she calls el mal de ojo in Cuba. That's how it's called, but we could maybe translate it in English as the devil eye. So she goes to get a cactus that has long spines. So she goes in the countryside. She comes back with this and puts that on a rooftop. And the idea is that what she thinks is that the cactus will burst the eyes of envious people or people who are trying to make bad things happen to her and her family, because she believes that for sure there's something happening. You know, there's someone who's trying to make her stop her construction or goes against her. So the cactus is there to stop those bad people, envious people of envying her or making bad things happen to her. So that's talking with her and other people that I realized, like, wow, the cactus are really powerful tools for some Cubans who believe in their power, as powerful as a Wi-Fi antenna. You know, it's a technology that Cuban use for certain reasons, certain purposes, and people believe that it works as much as people believe in a Wi-Fi antenna works. So, and that's what I tried to do in the book, is to put different types of technologies, quote unquote, what we could say natural, some human invented, some related to religious belief, all at the same level. So all as things that help circulate or prevent circulate some forms of signals or things in the sky. So that's the cactus story. I think it's better told in the book, though. There's so much to say, as you can see.
There's a lot to say, and you do it so beautifully and succinctly. It's really amazing. But I think about John Durham Peters a lot when I read your book, and the idea of elemental media and sort of these things that we don't really consider media, but do transmit all kinds of information and things all the time, right?
John Durham Peters is my biggest influence in writing this book, and actually I still remember reading his book and being blown away by what I was actually reading. You know, like what I was reading was like, that's exactly what I wanted to do. You know, it spoke so much to me when I read his book that when I started to work on this guy, it just came up naturally, and he's definitely the biggest influence of this book. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that leads us straight to the pigeons, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
and the story of Marlin and his pigeons, and the pigeons as media, right? And there were some things that I was really struck by in this chapter. One is how little we really know about these carrier pigeons, right, who go and come back, and how much they were used in Cuba, not just in Cuba, but in other places as well. But also you work into the story really nicely this idea of these children, right? Like, Marlin is a child. I think he's 12 years old.
Yes.
And he goes, you know, he takes this train trip all day long, kind of like his pigeon. And, you know, he tells his mother he's going away on the train and he goes and then comes back. And I don't know if you sort of had that connection too, but the way that these, the children are also sort of circulating in Cuba. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes. But it's funny that you mentioned this, because when I wrote that chapter for the first time and I asked a friend to read it, her first comment was like, well, Alex, you have to, people will find it so weird, you know, that the child would take the train by himself and go in 200-300 kilometers. And she lives in the United States. And she said, in the United States, it's impossible. Like in Canada, of course, it's not. It would not be possible. But when I wrote it, I was just like, this is how it is. And in Cuba, like, there's not this fear of, and travel is very difficult. It's a big adventure, you know, to go in another city or to take the transportation to another place. It's never, never straightforward. There are always things happening. The bus breaks or something is not working well, or the train takes double time. But even then, I think that it would not be that surprising, you know, if this would happen. Maybe not that common that I wanted to put it in the book, but it's still more common. It's still, I think children are way more free to move, even when we think about the neighborhood level, you know, like where kids are going from one house to another, as you say, circulation of the children from one house to another, and were raised by, you know, like this idea of like it takes a village to raise a kid. Well, in Cuba, that's for sure. That's what it is. And that's what's happening. People are everywhere in the street. They eat wherever they are. They drink water in any family. You know, like it's about this idea of it's way more open, way more fluid as a way of exchanging, I would put it like that. So kids are more part of normal daily life of going around and being loose a little bit in the city. And that's the beauty of it. When I go to Cuba, my son, 8, 9, 10 years old, sometimes I don't see him for hours, you know, and that's just normal. Like kids are from one place to another. They play. So it's a different way of looking at it. So yes, there's definitely a different way of thinking about children moving around.
Yeah, I was really struck by that. But maybe we can talk a little bit about pigeons. Are the pigeons? I wasn't sure in the book actually whether it was very common for people to have pigeons or whether it's an unusual thing for people to keep them and to sort of care for them as much as that child did.
Yeah, it is pretty common, actually. There are many, if I just look at the neighborhood where Marlon is a real character. He has a pigeon, so this is all true. So in his neighborhood, I would say central Santiago de Cuba, there are a lot of pigeon owners, every maybe 5 or 6 houses, all males. I never met any woman doing that. And the pigeon owners I talked to, they didn't know any woman doing that. So it's really a male thing, boys from all ages, and also who have different levels of passion for it. So some are just raising pigeons for fun. Others are very competitive. So different types of engagement with the pigeon, but a similar, I would say, love for those animals, and also a recognition of their capacity and their intelligence, mainly to orient themselves and to come back home. So this idea of like the pigeon, that you release the pigeon somewhere and it will come back home. It has that instinct of flying back to where its home is. So that was very, very strong for all the pigeon owners I talked to. And it might not be that common in every neighborhood, but I would say that in popular neighborhoods in Santiago de Cuba, and I know it's the same in Havana, there are a lot of it's very common to have pigeon owners and association and competition of releasing pigeons. So that's what the story is about. It's a young boy who's not part of the association of the Colombophilo, so the pigeon owners, but who likes to have pigeon and who's trying to raise to train his pigeon to fly back home. So how do they do this? Is they release the pigeon progressively the farther and farther and farther, and then in the hope that the pigeon will get that sense of, I would say, geolocalization type of sense of where its home is, and that the pigeon will be able to come back home, even if it's further and further. So he decides to take the train to release the pigeon very far, like at 200 kilometers. That's far for to train a pigeon. But he releases the pigeon, and that's the story of how it comes back to the home, which we don't really know how. And what's interesting about it is how pigeon owners think that the pigeons can find its way home. Also, we've talked about the concept of truth before, and for this book, I was not really interested in what is the truth, you know, how I was not interested in finding out how pigeons really come back home, or how the cactus really works, or if it really works, and if it's just a belief or if it's reality. My interest was how people talk about it. What are the stories associated with those objects, animals, or beliefs? That was really my interest. So the pigeon like comes back home, but we don't know how. Like, so we can read scientific articles to kind of figure it out and trying to find answers. But what really interested me was how pigeon owners talked about it. And so that's what I tried to put in the story.
And then you move to the lottery and the way the numbers from the lottery come up across the ocean from the on the radio from Miami, right? And that made me think of, the kinds of stories that people might tell about that. And it seems to me that they might be about winning and not winning and the arbitrariness of it all, right? Which is kind of resonant with the arbitrariness of ending up on one side of the divide or another, ending up in Cuba or in Miami in some way. But then also continuing that long continuous connection, which was, you know, strengthened through radio back in the, you know, early 20th century. So how did you come to the lottery as an idea as a thing to talk about?
Well, the lottery, because that's what I love about the type of work that we're doing, the type of research that we're doing. And I'm sure that this will resonate with some of the people who listen to us right now. But when you're in the field or doing research and you find out or learn about something like the lottery in Cuba, it again just blows your mind, and you're like, what, something like this exists, you know, because lottery is illegal in Cuba, but Cubans found a way to play lottery, and a lot of Cubans play, but it's all underground, it's all illegal, and the numbers that are picked up are transmitted from Miami. And those numbers travel everywhere on the island, and it's all organized, you know, like locally in different types of bank, what they call the bankers, who have their own structure and people working for them to collect the money, etc. So the structure itself is just impressive and amazing, and because it's. Because it's not part of the state system, but it works so well, and it's just there, and it's almost invisible, but it's there, and it's huge. And you have all the, I would say, the religious, the symbols that are associated with each of those numbers. So each of the numbers that are part of the the lottery. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, up to, I can't remember right now, I think it's 99. Each number has its own symbols. And then Cubans are very sensitive to things that they might see, things that they might think about, dreams, things that they might come across, anything that could reveal what will be the winning number of the lottery. So they might dream about, like in the story, about a horse, or they might, someone might tell them about the good fish soup that they ate, and oh, a fish soup, you know, all of those symbols that Cubans will associate with numbers on an everyday life basis is very, very strong. And again, when you start paying attention to that, you find out how important and how big it is, but how it can so easily escape your attention if you don't really know what Cubans are talking about, because of course they all have a language to talk about it that it's not really obvious. But you were talking also about you know, like being born in on one side or another, like the winning numbers and losing. And after I finished the book, I realized that a lot of the things that I talk about in the book are connected with the concept of luck. I talk a lot about luck, but in different ways. Being lucky, or even like, but how you can facilitate luck. You know, how you can make things easier for you. How can you be more lucky or luckier? So, and the lottery chapter, it's really strong in that chapter. How can you be attentive to the symbols and the things that happen to you in life that will facilitate or that will make you a winner, basically, that you will win the lottery. And so this is just each chapter is kind of a fascinating discovery for me that I decided to dig a little bit more with my research.
Yeah, you pull all kinds of things out. And the last chapter is all about the conga, right? And this kind of evocation of the city and people moving through the streets and the music also connecting people through, I guess, through the air, right? To continue with the sky theme. And so why did you end with the conga, and how does it kind of bring, what does it bring together to pull the story towards its conclusion?
So the conga for me brings the sound element, so the sonic aspect, so the sound traveling in the you know, the vibrations basically influencing the hair pressure and making us listeners or people who can hear. I thought that I'm a visual anthropologist, but I'm also very interested in sound. And up to chapter 4, I thought that the book was really good, but then I was, or the ideas were very good. And, but I thought that something was missing more in the sonic aspect, you know, and I think that the conga really brings that, because it's about circulation in the city, but it's also about this sound that is so present in Cuba, that is everywhere, and I wanted to convey that the presence of sound all the time, everywhere you go, that is louder, you know, this idea that you can't really always, I mean, it's not the same relation with sound that, let's say, I have here in Victoria, BC. It's another relation with sound. And when you travel to Cuba and you're not necessarily used to it, I think that it comes up, you know, you realize how sound is differently expressed, and how people relate with sound in a different way. So the idea of the conga, which is a very important form of sound making or a form of cultural expression in Santiago de Cuba, I wanted to explore that spontaneous form of street parade or street expression or noise, you know, that people make in the street as a as a way to engage with the city, with the sounds that are made in the city, and also of how sound is just something that circulates all the time in Santiago. So it's mainly because I thought the sound was missing, although sound was so important in that location. That's why I decided to end the book with the conga.
Yeah. So I've taken up lots of your time, and I just have one more question for you, which is, I'm wondering what you want readers to take away. I know that I took away many things, but the one of the big picture things that I took away was that this book is a kind of sideways look at what people call the special period, right? Like there's a lot of the literature on the special period, and I think that this really sort of moves beyond that in distinct kinds of ways, in the sense that it's really grounded in everyday, and there's a lot of activity that happens beyond the state or outside of the state or mm-hmm. beyond a lot of these kinds of things, and there's not this kind of sense of moving towards the end of a regime or anything like that, or it's a really kind of very thick and textured look at everyday life. And I don't know if that's what you wanted people to take away. That's what I took away.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure. That's one of the things we talk about the fact that Cuba is in a state of transition for so many years already.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And transition to what? Yes, I would agree. Of course, they are in the transition, but we don't know for what. Plus, it's a transition that lasts so long. Are we still talking about a transition? So I wanted to, as you say, move away from that. And I've engaged with politics in the past, so I felt I had done that. And also because when you talk to Cubans, they don't talk about transition. They don't talk about those type of questions that we are so interested in finding or in researching. What they talk about is what I tried to put in the book. You know, when I talk to them about cactus or pigeon or the conga, they had so many things to say. Versus if I ask them about, do you think? I would not ask them, do you think you are in a transition phase? I would never ask that. But you see what I mean? When it's just like when you talk to them about their passion or what they're interested in, there's so much that they talk about, and they rarely, like never, talk about transition or the state, you know, like the big state. It's not something that comes up, I don't think, ever in a conversation naturally. So that's one thing, but I also wanted to bring the poetic of course the sky, but also of the stories. There's also my interest to explore new forms and new methodologies in social science and anthropology, looking at more like concept like imagination, but also using drawings and collaboration. So like outside of Cuba, you know, I also had interest in thinking about new ways of doing research and new ways of thinking about interpreting stories that people tell me about certain things. And of course, like about Cuba is to get to know, because it's so focused on different objects. That was a very interesting way for me actually to work. You know, once I decided those five objects, so Wi-Fi, cactus, pigeon, lottery, conga, then it just went so well because like the stories developed around those objects. So those objects became, or animals, but they became the center of many, many stories and many connections. So I found it was an amazing way to work, and a new way for me to find out about things that I had not thought about before while conducting field work in Cuba. So it opened new ways of looking at things or new ways of thinking about things that I didn't think about before. I don't know if it makes sense, but it's just it just opened the way for a new perspective on things.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I think that readers will have the same experience. Thank you so much for talking to me today. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you very much. Me too. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.